Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
I'm Erica Wise, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to
From Them About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
And I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey on all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Mary and I are fresh back from Durham, North Carolina, where she did some great presentations on speed brewing and where her head was projected on the wall on the Jumbotron. Bigger than I've ever seen her, and it was pretty awesome. You know.
This was the All About Beers World Beer Festival at the Durham Bulls Park.
That's right.
The new park.
Hit the bull, win a steak. Hit the grass, win a salad.
Did you ever figure out what that meant?
Not exactly, no.
All right, let's go to some announcements. All right, first of all, I think I had mentioned this, that our local homebrew store, Bitter Nesters, did a speed brewing competition. So all of the entrants used recipes from my book or recipes that were inspired by the book. They all had to be made in, I think, 3 weeks or less. So congratulations to the winners. I helped judge, and it was awesome. It was super cool to see both my recipes being made by other people and then also riffs on the recipes. So congratulations to Evie for first place. She had a guava soda. Second place was Josh and Shauna. They made a ginger chai tea mead. And third place was Katarina and Sean. They made an elderberry herbal mead that was back sweetened lightly. And then honorable mention to Ian for a cucumber saison and Jeremy for a mead with tangerine peel. So that was super fun.
That's not the only awesome stuff that's happened with your recipes lately. Out in Long Island, at LibMe, the Long Island Beer and Malt Enthusiast, they have a competition. Is it yearly or seasonally?
I don't know.
Anyway,
that's the part I don't remember.
They have a giant sword that
it's a saber.
It's a righteous sword. It's not exactly a saber. It's pretty righteous. It's a full on sword. The winner of the homebrew competitions end up with their name engraved on this sword, and the winner of this,
Chris Dolan, who is now actually a brewer at Blue Point Brewing Company, he made my Bananas Foster Short Bochet recipe and took the competition, which is awesome because he beat out a bunch of beers.
So Bananas Foster Short Mead Bouchet.
Short Bouchet, yeah.
How do you make that? What?
So Bouchet is just a caramelized honey. So you caramelize the honey first. So you basically simmer it or boil it for a period of time until it gets dark and caramelly and has more flavor, just like you would caramelize a sugar.
And you're turning some of those sugars into non-fermentable sugars, increasing the body and giving that caramelly taste.
Yeah, a little bit of color. And then I used freeze-dried bananas and a little bit of rum.
And hit it with champagne yeast?
Yeah. Champagne yeast. It's really easy, fast,
and
delicious.
Now it's officially an award-winning recipe, which is
yes.
Cool.
Okay, the other announcement that we have back to Bitter Nesters. They are having Ales for ALS, Great Beer for a Great Cause event, October 29th at 6:30 p.m. So those of you who are homebrewers might have heard of this. Ales for ALS is a collaboration between Loftus Ranches, YCH Hops, and homebrewers around the country. So basically they are offering up the new variety of hops, HBC 438, to homebrewers, and then, you know, asking them to brew with it and then getting feedback. So Bitter Nesters has hooked up with one of our local homebrew clubs, the Bruminaries. Each brewer received 2 ounces of the HBC 438, and they are brewing Saison, Pale Ale, Belgian IPA, Imperial Red Ale, American Brown Ale, English brown ale and an English special bitter with this hop. So if you want to come see how that hop expresses itself, if you haven't used it or if you have used it and are curious how it works in other styles, come by Bitter Nesters on October 29th at 6:30. It's going to be $10 and there are only 50 tickets available. So go to their site, bitterandesters.com, if you would like to attend to grab your ticket.
And every Thursday, henceforth, at Kelso Brewing Company, Kelly Taylor will be in the house to share bottles. It's basically a unmarked bottle guessing kind of thing. If you guess the style of a bottle correctly, then you'll get free discounted beer for the rest of the evening in our tap room on Thursday night. So it's 529 Waverly Avenue in Brooklyn. We welcome homebrew sharers coming down and tasting these bottles, but we'd also like to taste your beers. Come on down. Also, happening in Philadelphia, here to talk about that is Reverend Tim Rosmus from Brooklyn Brewery.
How to do, gang?
How to do.
So, yeah, the Philly Mash is coming up for the Brooklyn Brewery crew. We're going to be down there from the 17th to the 24th next week. We've got a whole bunch of folks coming in. We do a ton of stuff in a week's time. We kick off with a free concert Saturday night with Man Man and Prince Rama, which should be pretty awesome. And I really hope that I'm pronouncing Rama correctly. It might be Rama. Not totally sure. And there's dinner parties, there's beer events, there's all sorts of cool stuff going on. And you can check all that out at brooklynbrewerymash.com.
And Tim, you're hot off Comic Con, aren't you?
I am indeed.
Can you give us just a brief recap of what happened there?
Comic Con is always more or less a total sensory overload. but every year we do the Defender Project with them, where we come up with a beer and a character with an illustrator, and we release it for Comic Con specifically. So this year we worked with Kari Randolph, who's drawn the X-Men, he's drawn Batman, he's working on an I Am Robin series right now. And this year, for the first time, we're releasing the beer year-round and everywhere.
And it's a delicious beer, man.
It's awesome. It's a good red IPA, nice and juicy, and the character's awesome. I wrote the backstory, Kari drew the character, and it's coming out in bottles, and they look awesome. They look so cool.
And you were on a panel at Comic-Con, right?
I was. I moderated a panel about creativity and the audience. And there was a bunch of brewers and illustrators kind of coming together and not quite complaining about receiving feedback. Which is really cool. It was neat. Comics and beer kind of have this parallel thing where both are kind of emerging from the fringes now. You know, 15 years ago, we couldn't come and talk about craft beer, and 10 years ago, there was no Comic-Con. So now you have all of these, like, hardcore, dyed-in-the-wool nerds butting up against the mainstream that are drinking these beers, reading these comics, and it's interesting to see how that friction comes back to the creators and how they're trying to kind of appease both sides of that.
Right on. By nerds, you mean enthusiasts, right?
Oh, yes. Nerds, geeks, however you label yourself.
Whatever we call ourselves.
Yeah. I've been a proud nerd since marching band, so I don't feel bad throwing it out there.
And there is also actually the All About Beer, the current issue, has an article about kind of comic and beer and
intertwined world.
Yeah, definitely. It's always cool. Chris and I are always interested in, you know, kind of the intersection between craft and beer or other crafts and beer.
Yeah.
Beer does intersect with a lot of different crafts and fermentation is one of them, and all sorts of fermentation. There's a lot of crossover through that, and which brings us to our guest for today.
So a few weeks ago, I'm sure we've mentioned this on the show, we attended an absolutely amazing workshop. Chris got to attend at one, and I got to attend two. But David Asher, who is cheese guru at Black Sheep Cheesemaking, School of Cheesemaking. I don't have that in front of me right now. Yes, I do. Okay, and then also wrote this amazing book called The Art of Natural Cheesemaking. So Slow Food kind of co-sponsored and brought him into town. He did a lecture on Friday night at Crown Finish Caves in Brooklyn, and then did four different cheesemaking classes throughout the weekend. And I will say I've taken a ricotta workshop before, but cheesemaking is very intimidating, even to somebody who's, you know, I'm pretty hot on fermenting. I've fermented a lot of beverages and bread, you know, bread, sauerkraut. But cheesemaking has always been a little bit more intimidating, and I think that's true for everybody. And I got to say, David Asher completely turned me on to a whole new world. And Chris and I both came out of that with with an absolute desire to start making cheese. As soon as this wedding is over, we're going to start cheese making. So welcome to the show, David Asher.
Here to talk about David Asher is David Asher.
Thank you. What a great introduction. Happy to be here. Back in Brooklyn.
Yeah, you're back in Brooklyn. Absolutely.
And totally sincere. I mean, it was a mind-blowing class for me. So first of all, tell us who you are and where are you?
I'm based out in British Columbia. I run my traveling cheese school out of the west coast of British Columbia, Canada. But I'm currently on the road touring around Ontario, actually doing some consulting right now with a sheep cheesemaker in central Ontario, showing them how to make a more natural cheese.
When we talk about natural cheese, what was your journey? How did you get to where you're going? Right, or how did you get so into cheese
and fermentation?
And fermentation and do it DIY. Yeah.
Well, I've been fermenting for a really, really, really long time, about 10, 15 years now. And my first fermentations were sourdough bread baking, sauerkraut making, and kefir making. And I've been keeping those cultures at home for a really long time, really enjoying the nuances and development of flavors in these really wonderful traditional ferments. But I didn't really realize I could make cheese until someone showed me that you could do it at home without any specialized tools or equipment, that you didn't need any. You didn't need a cheese cave. You didn't need a factory setting to do it. You could do it in your own home kitchen. And this one cheesemaker kind of showed me the way of cheese, and I took this inspiration with me back home and started on my very own cheesemaking journey.
Awesome. So what do you mean by your book is titled The Art of Natural Cheesemaking. What do you mean by the art of natural cheesemaking?
So I practice a different style of cheesemaking from what most North Americans practice, and I proclaim my cheesemaking to be much more natural than the standard practiced in North America, which I call an industrial-style cheesemaking. My methods are very different because I cultivate the cultures of cheese, whereas most cheesemakers, when they make their cheese, whether they be large-scale industrial cheesemakers or artisanal cheesemakers, they source the culture of their cheese from packages of freeze-dried culture, just like you'd source the culture for brewing a certain beer from like a package of freeze-dried yeast. Now, in my cheesemaking, I encourage people to keep all the cultures that they can use to make their cheese happen. And I show folks in the book how they can use kefir as a starter culture for making a wide variety of cheeses, and how they can easily cultivate the different ripening cultures that help cheeses evolve their particular flavors.
Awesome.
And, a lot more of a traditionally inspired cheesemaking, and a lot more fun to practice at home than like the sterile, freeze-dried cheesemaking that's practiced by most cheesemakers in the U.S. and it's preached by most of the cheesemaking guidebooks that are out there.
And what really this style of cheesemaking is replicating more how cheesemaking has originally been done all across the world and how these different styles of cheese developed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my inspiration for the ideas behind the book were that cheesemakers historically, we were able to make all the different styles of cheeses that we know and love without the use of commercial freeze-dried cultures. Like every cheese we make was invented before we had a scientific understanding of the microbiology and chemistry involved in cheesemaking. And I went out and sought out the traditional methods for making different styles of cheese. And the book is a distillation of all of those different methods that I've been exploring in the past 10 years of cheesemaking.
Awesome.
Yeah. Why kefir?
And what is kefir? So obviously, there's a lot of people that might be listening that are familiar with kefir. We've done a milk kefir show before, but a lot of people don't know what it is. It's not as common of a culture as even a kombucha SCOBY. So what is kefir and why?
So kefir is a fascinating dairy culture. It's like a traditional yogurt from Central Asia. But really, it's more of a fermented milk. That's kind of what I call it, a fermented milk. And it's made by taking kefir culture, adding it to milk, and letting the milk ferment for 24 hours. And the milk thickens up to a beautiful buttermilk-like texture with a little bit of effervescence and a little bit of alcohol. And it's a really delicious probiotic drink. And also a wonderful cheese-making starter that contains a really broad diversity of microorganisms that can help cheeses evolve their particular characters. And the one of the most distinguishing things about the kefir culture, and many people who drink kefir may not know about this, because when you're drinking kefir you get from the grocery store, it's not actually true kefir made with real kefir culture. It's made with packages of freeze-dried starter, much like most of the cheese made in North America. But kefir, traditional kefir, is made with what's known as, with a culture that's known as a kefir grain. And it's just, the kefir grain's like a, it's a SCOBY, like a kombucha mother, only much cuter. And these little cauliflower-like grains, these little cauliflower-like grains that grow in milk, you put them into, you ferment the milk into kefir or kefir, and then you take the grains out, the kefir grains out, put them into some more milk, and they ferment that milk into kefir again. And you can kind of keep this culture going over and over and over again, feeding it every day, and as you feed it, the culture grows and thrives.
We're going to take a really quick break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about how to get kefir to cheese.
Well, and the ingredients that you need. It really is simple.
Ferment it.
In 1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hi, this is Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. And you know, I remember my very first show, December 2009. Ooh, it was a cold winter. And my first guest was William Grimes from the New York Times. Now, the one specific I had to tell him was wear a hat, gloves, and a warm coat, because our studio had no heat. We had no heat in the winter. We had no air conditioning in the summertime. It was rough going, but we were a startup, and we had a good show, regardless of the fact that we could see our breath. So today, we still have hurdles to climb over, and the only way we can get there is with your help. So if you would please consider being a member and press that little beating heart button in the upper right-hand corner to donate. It's going to help us have heat and electricity and air conditioning and really good sound with really great guests. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Foment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We have David Asher, author of The Art of Natural Cheesemaking, on the line, and we are talking all things cheesemaking. And we've just talked about kefir, milk kefir. And
so we actually have our first intern, Rachel Jacobs. Rachel, say hi, Rachel.
Hello.
So she's sitting in with us for the first time, and she said, where do you get kefir grains? So talk a little bit about that.
Sorry, I had trouble hearing you for a moment there. Oh. You were cutting out. I missed the question.
So where do you get kefir grains? Where does one get kefir grains?
So the only way to get kefir grains is to find someone that's got kefir grains and convince them to share them with you. Fortunately, most people are really generous with their kefir grains because they've often used them as a gift, and so they're happy to pass them along to anybody who'd like them. And there's plenty of people online who breed kefir grains, so you can Google kefir breeders online, and often you just send them $20 cash in the mail, and they'll send you back kefir grains dried. These dried sphere grains come back and put into fresh milk, and they'll come back to life again, just like dairy sea monkeys.
So let's talk about the basic ingredients of cheese making. So the first thing is milk, and milk is very important in cheese making. So let's talk about just, you know, most people out there, we go to the grocery store, you buy your milk, you eat your cereal or your oatmeal or whatever, chocolate milk, glass of milk, but there's much more to milk than that. So talk about quality milk and the difference in milks.
Yeah, so milk has a remarkable ability to change over time. And milk degrades quite quickly in the refrigerator. And you may not notice it when you're pouring it over your Cocoa Pops or your coffee in the morning. But milk, as it sits in the refrigerator, it often sours quite a bit. It becomes dominated by wild microorganisms that thrive even in cold temperature. And if milk is older, if it's sitting around a long time, it doesn't really make good cheese, because those wild microorganisms can kind of take over the development of the cheese and give it bitter, weird flavors. So freshness is really, really important when you're sourcing your milk. You know, the fresher you can get it, the better. Like right out of the udder, warm from the animal is absolute best. But if you can't get that, you know, the grocery stores increasingly have really good milk available for home cheesemakers. Lots of local producers, I noticed when I was in New York City just a few weeks ago. And if you're looking for good milk for cheesemaking, seek out a milk that's as fresh as possible, but also that's processed as little as possible. So preferably a milk that's unhomogenized, which really seriously affects its cheesemaking ability. So look for a cream-lined milk. And if you can get it, if you're in a place where raw milk is available, raw milk makes a huge difference to the cheesemaking process. And milk that hasn't been processed at all responds best to the cheesemaking process.
And in New York, we are not allowed to get raw milk.
Well, we can buy raw milk directly from the farm. There are a few states, notably, I believe, Pennsylvania and Connecticut, in the Northeast, where you can buy... I've bought raw milk in the store in Pennsylvania. But otherwise, oftentimes, you can find another source. You maybe befriend a local farmer. There are some underground milk clubs around the country. So it is possible to get really good quality milk. And even if you can, a lot of the health food stores will have just regular pasteurized, not ultra pasteurized, fresh milk.
That makes a difference too.
Yeah. Just, right. You know, you could check your date and get it, you know, as local as possible is best, obviously.
So depending on what kind of cheese I want to make, can I do it all from kefir as a starter?
Yeah. In my experience, and in many of my students' experiences and people I've been working with, kefir can serve as a universal starter for making just about every style of cheese. So I use my kefir for making mozzarella, for making cheddars, for making camemberts and brie, for making fresh and aged ghost cheeses. It's got all the microorganisms that any cheese needs. It's got an array of different organisms, like 70 to 80 different species, that have been tested in kefir, and the diversity of microorganisms in kefir is actually really similar to microorganisms that are present in raw milk. And you can use kefir as a starter culture in making cheeses, and the cheeses will take on a very strong raw milk-like character, even if the milk is pasteurized.
What you explain in your workshop, as well as in the book, is that you're basically manipulating, you're manipulating this milk that has the kefir using rennet, which we're going to get to in a second. But you're basically manipulating that in order to kind of select for these specific organisms to get a particular type of cheese.
That's right. So in a modern cheese making and industrial cheese making today, cheesemakers will add a particular starter culture, a particular single strain of starter culture for making a particular style of cheese. So they'll source a different freeze-dried culture for making chèvre, a different freeze-dried culture for making cheddar, a different freeze-dried culture for making camembert and blue cheese. And all told, if a home cheesemaker wants to follow these techniques, according to the industrial cheese making book, they'll have to buy 10 or 11 different starter cultures and keep them in their freezer and open them up every time they want to use every time they want to make a particular style of cheese. But with a more traditional cheesemaking method, or a kefir cheesemaking method, as I preach, using kefir with its diversity of microorganisms allows the culture to adapt to many different styles of cheesemaking. And if you're making a chèvre with kefir as a starter culture, the particular conditions that you create when you make that goat cheese allows the right cultures in kefir or raw milk to thrive. Enables a chef to take on the flavors and character that's known for. And if you want to make a camembert, then if you follow the appropriate technique, the right microorganisms in the kefir will come to life and will help the cheese develop the appropriate flavor and the appropriate beautiful white fungal rind on its surface. And the techniques that I practice are traditionally inspired, and surprisingly, they work rather consistently. Idea out there that the traditional methods of cheese making are inconsistent to make a poor quality cheese, but in my experience, these traditional cultures make a much more flavorful cheese, and also help the cheese evolve in a much stronger, more resilient way. And I found that I don't have to cultivate perfectly sterile conditions to make my cheese, but in the industrial method using these freeze-dried single-strain cultures, you have to create perfectly sterile conditions so that unwanted microorganisms don't come in and spoil a batch of cheese.
And that was one thing I was really impressed with in the class, is that, you know, you were teaching us a particular style, like we went over, I believe, blue cheese, but in the class you were able to just, you know, kind of riff, and you also made a ricotta, you made fresh cheese curds, and that was kind of unplanned, but you were able to do that because you're, you know, well, not only do you know everything about natural cheese making, but, you know, you're starting this with this amazing culture. So that was something super cool and was really, very cool. So let's talk about another ingredient. The other important ingredient is rennet. So what is rennet?
So rennet's a coagulating enzyme that cheesemakers use to help coax the curds out of the milk. Rennet traditionally comes from the fourth stomach of a young calf that has to be slaughtered for cheesemakers to gain access to this enzyme that's naturally present on the young animal's stomach. The reason why this enzyme is present on a young calf's stomach is because when that young calf is drinking its mother's milk, the young calf transformed its mother's milk into cheese inside its belly as a result of these enzymes on the lining of its stomach. Cheesemakers traditionally would slaughter calves or lambs or kids, goat kids, that is, dry out the stomach, known as a vel, cure it and dry it out with salt, and then use that vel as the coagulant for making their cheeses. Today, however, the vast majority of cheeses are made with microbial rennet. So these are rennet substitutes, often considered vegetarian rennet, so they don't involve the slaughter of an animal. And in my impression, these microbial rennet replacements aren't as natural as the traditional method, and bring up their own kind of ethical questions that are perhaps even greater than the question of the slaughter of animals or the use of rennet in cheesemaking. Because many of these rennet alternatives are produced by agribusiness and chemical corporations, and as an organic, natural cheesemaker, I'd rather not support the corporate agenda in my cheesemaking.
Yep. Do they produce a similar or equal flavor in the end?
They do.
Just curious if there's a
It depends on which coagulant you're talking about. There's a wide range of them. So the standard microbial coagulant that's used in cheese making today, in which 90% of cheese consumed in North America is made from, works in almost exactly the same way as traditional rennet, because it essentially is the same chemical. It's the exact same enzyme, chymosin, but this microbial version of chymosin comes from genetically modified organisms. And so using this this rennet replacement that works the same as calf rennet brings up all sorts of ethical questions.
Right.
Now, there is another rennet, a microbial rennet that's available on the market, which is also microbial. This particular rennet doesn't work. It's not genetically modified, so they don't have that question. But it doesn't work as well as calf rennet. It makes the curd a little bit squeaky in texture, a little bit rubbery in texture. And if you age a cheese that's made with this rennet, it kind of takes on bitter, sharp flavors as it ages, which aren't as nice as a cheese made with a more natural rennet.
And this natural rennet is available pretty easily online.
Yeah, there's quite a few producers of it, but none in North America, surprisingly. There's no natural rennet production in North America. The rennet I use comes from Austria, I believe, which is where I think one of the last few remaining traditional rennet makers exists.
Cool. So let's go to the book. So as I said, I mean, I think this book is amazing, and as someone who has recently also written a book, it takes a lot of work to write a book. So how long did it take you to write this book? I mean, first of all, this book is gorgeous. There's a ton of photos. It's incredibly thorough. There's 23 chapters, and you take people through making everything from fresh cheeses such as paneer to blue cheeses, cheddar. You have sourdough bread recipes in there. You have a great troubleshooting guide. And everything is very down to earth. Like, you really explain how things work. So how long did it take you to write this book?
All told, it was about 2 years from like when I started writing my first chapters for my book proposal to the publishers, to when I actually had the finished copy in hand. But it was about probably 10 months of writing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
yeah,
12 months of writing,
yeah.
and cheese making. Of course, I had to make all the cheeses that are featured in all the photos of the book.
And
I didn't want to cheat and buy any cheeses
right.
from the grocery store. But you know, if I really wanted the recipe to shine, I had to show exactly what the cheeses look like if they were made.
Absolutely.
One of my favorite things that I took home from that class too was that. As a brewer, I'm always scared of cross-contamination, but you have different cheeses, you know, developing in the same cheese container. Like your blue is not turning your other cheeses into a blue.
Yeah. So this goes against one of the fundamental beliefs of cheesemaking, that like the different cultures of cheese can contaminate one another, and each different style of cheese should be kept in a completely different aging environment because the cheeses are likely to cross-contaminate each other. But in my experience, that belief is only true for the industrial style of cheesemaking using these packaged freeze-dried cultures. And if you use more traditional cultures, you actually and cultivate the right conditions that allow the right cultures to thrive, you can age a blue cheese right next to a white rinded cheese, and the two cheeses won't contaminate each other because each cheese each cheese has the perfect conditions for the particular cultures that are growing on it to thrive, and they won't mess with each other. So in my cheese cave, I have all these different cultures coexisting really peacefully, and it's really beautiful and inspirational to see.
Yeah.
And you also explain how anyone can make kind of a mini cheese cave in their own refrigerator in the book, which is awesome.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so many of the cheeses in the book can be aged just in a small a plastic container lined with like a bamboo sushi mat that helps preserve the humidity of the cheeses inside. And if you place that container inside a cool environment, like a fridge or a cool basement, you can create the right conditions for aging cheese. All they need is low temperatures and high humidity and some care as they're aging, and cheeses are actually quite easy to ripen to perfection at home.
So I kind of hate to ask this question because it's often asked of me or us. You know, people ask us, what's your favorite beer or what's your favorite recipe from the book? But do you have a favorite cheese or two that you just really enjoy making?
Oh, yeah, I definitely do. My favorite is Chev, just straight up fresh goat cheese.
By the way, Mary, this is totally fair because at the beginning of the class, he asked this of us for what our favorite cheeses were.
That's true. That's
that was
true.
His first question to us was that.
You're getting your revenge now, right?
That's right.
Yes. Yeah. So why Chev? So Chev is a fresh goat's milk cheese.
That's right.
So why?
So it's a. And it's super delicious, like remarkably tasty for a fresh cheese that's only 2 days old, and really really easy to make. It's like something you barely even have to focus on while you're making it. You just have to do a little bit here, a little bit there, and after 2 days, your goat's milk transforms into a beautiful cheese. You just warm up the milk, add some kefir culture, add a tiny tiny little bit of rennet, just a very very small dose. Let the milk sit at room temperature to ferment for 24 hours. And after the curd has set, which doesn't take very long, you then take that curd and strain it into some cheesecloth, let it hang for 6 hours, mix in some salt, let it hang for another hour, and the cheese is done. And it's delicious.
That's awesome. Yeah. That might be the first thing we make.
Yeah.
So where can folks buy your book? So again, it's called The Art of Natural Cheesemaking. And I will say, I mean, it really is an amazing book, and we have quite a book collection at this point, but it definitely has, you know, like I said, and I'm totally sincere with this, cheese making is very intimidating, even for people that ferment a lot, and your book is absolutely wonderful. So where can people buy your book?
So my book is available at lots of small independent bookstores. You can find it in many libraries. You can also find it online at just about every online retailer. I'd recommend picking it up directly from my publisher, Chelsea Green, and you can order the book online at their website, chelseagreen.com.
Awesome.
And if there is an Eric out there listening, I have a signed copy dedicated to Eric. Blessed are the cheesemakers, from David.
There is a little story behind that. No. So you just said you're doing consulting and you give workshops. So do you have any upcoming workshops in U.S. or Canada?
Ooh, in the Northeast. I will be having some events this winter. February, I'll be scheduling a couple of cheese making retreats in Vermont through Shelburne Farm.
Yep, awesome. Also, and, an amazing museum in Shelburne.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to being there. I'll also be doing a class in upcoming weeks down in Maryland, at Sally Fallon's farm.
Oh, very cool. And so
that's in the works.
And you'll have both of those on your website, correct?
Yes, and you can find more information on that upcoming classes on my website, theblacksheepschool.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, David Asher. And again, any of you who are out there who are interested, you know, you've been curious about cheese making, this book is the book to have.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's incredibly readable, and I mean, because there are other cheese making books out there. They're not so friendly to the general fermenting public, and yours is. And I just love the idea of, you know, having this culture that you can use over and over again, and make delicious cheeses. So thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to talk.
Awesome. Well, cheers, and we'll be back next Monday on Ferment About It.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates, to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.